Outside Looking In is the title of Gary Wills' memoir. Wills is the academic classicist who turned to journalism while never leaving the academy. He has written over the years for National Review, Esquire, and for many years for the New York Review of Books. His own books about Nixon, Lincoln, and Christianity, and many other subjects, have been bestsellers, prize winners, and more important, cultural landmarks that have altered the way we talk and think about our history and our politics. Gary Wills joins us from Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois, where he is professor of history emeritus. Welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
And first, this idea of outsiderness or outsiderliness, whatever. You've interviewed presidents, presidential candidates. You've been at the White House. One could say that you've been inside more interesting places than you've been outside. What do you mean by being an outsider?
Well, I was always inside as an observer, never as a participant. And I said that to myself very early on. When I first went to see Bill Buckley when I was in graduate school, he tried to hire me as a drama critic, and I said, no, I'm going to go on and get my doctorate. And so I was never a member of a staff of a magazine or a newspaper or a political campaign or any of those things, which I think helped me observe a little more dispassionately than I would have otherwise.
William F. Buckley, who created the National Review, is one of the people you write about. You also write very fondly about Studs Terkel, the great radio interviewer from Chicago, self-described old lefty.
Right.
Those friends cover a lot of ground on the political spectrum.
I know, but it was so easy to like them both, I must say. And it was impossible to dislike Studs. People tried hard, but if they got within his orbit, they failed.
He was famous for plain speaking. William F. Buckley, the most elegant speaker of recent times in our national life. You write that he was a man who perhaps wasn't quite so erudite as he came off in public.
No, he was not a person who really read. He was quick. He was as fast as could be at picking things up. Paul Weiss's professor at Yale said he's very good at discussing books he's never read.
A great talent for being a public intellectual.
Oh, absolutely. He tried for years to write a serious book and decided that that was not his métier.
You write about interviewing Richard Nixon when he was running for president in 1968 and asking a question that became a staple not only of yours but of all kinds of interviewers. The question had not been asked before. What's an influential book that you've read? I want you to relate what Nixon said.
Yeah, he was... The most thoughtful responded to that question. That's the first time I ever asked that question. Now it's asked all the times, but I thought I had made it up in 1968. Mm-hmm. But I asked many politicians later on. And the amazing thing is that his answer was long and thoughtful. It was the life of Beveridge, and it was not anything you would have expected.
You have to explain who Beveridge was here.
He was a Republican, but he was an admirer of John Marshall and the Federalists. So he was a maverick, as was Claude Bowers.
Who wrote the book.
Yeah. So it was an unexpected answer and a very wise answer, I thought.
There were no votes in that answer, so far as you know.
No, no. No, he really was an intellectually curious person.
Yeah. And as you described him in first the Esquire article, but later the book, Nixon Agonistes, he was a man who found it very advantageous to play down his intellect in public
life. That's right. That's a regular game now, but he was early at it.
You proceeded to ask that same question about an influential book of several other people, and the answers you got are quite interesting, and never so impressive, I might add, as Nixon's answer.
Well, Hillary Clinton's was pretty impressive, too. I said to her, and she answered right away. Normally, they stall and try to think what will impress you. But she answered right away, The Brothers Karamazov. And I said, why? And she said, I read it in high school and it opened a whole range of spirituality I'd never even conceived of.
Now, when you asked the question of then Vice President George H.W. Bush, he was quite open. He didn't read much.
No, he said, now I don't have time. He said, of course, I read in school. You read the classics, Moby Dick. He said, the one that did impress me when I was in prep school was Catcher in the Rye, which was not published for two years after he was out of prep school.
With prep school.
So I guessed that he was remembering that his sons had read it in prep school.
It was a very charitable guess on your part.
And he was piggybacking on them.
Now, there's a chapter in the book called Jack. It's about your father.
Mm-hmm.
And you describe this very dynamic, difficult man who would often, it seems, justify his persistence or recklessness by saying, "There is no such word as cannot in the Wills Dictionary." And you write, "One of the reasons I am a conservative is that I do not believe that cannot should be removed from the dictionary." What do you mean by that?
Well, what was in some ways charming, often exasperating about my father is that he really believed that there are no limits. You can do anything. And he could get away with anything. And often he did. But it's a ruinous course of life.
Perhaps the caution that comes with Kant is part of the making of a conservative.
And of a sane life. You know?
Sane life.
I'm a great admirer of Samuel Johnson, who is a great believer in limits.
A theme that runs throughout your book and throughout your life is a love of books and the great importance of what great books have meant to you throughout your life. Does that make one an outsider in the
U.S.?
Well,
it can. It makes you look at things at a certain remove. Actually, you're at a remove, of course, when you're reading. And I was a bookworm from the very beginning and to this day. There's practically no minute of the day that I don't have a book in hand, when eating, when walking, and doing all kinds of things. So I suppose it can. It was a blessing in my case. Most of the good things that have happened in my life happened because of books, including meeting my wife.
Yes, she was the flight attendant who noticed what you were reading, and that's how you met.
Said I was too young to be reading Bergson.
You're too young to be reading Henri Bergson. I've never had a conversation with a flight attendant like that, I have to say.
No, well, she was a different one.
Yeah. Are you reading something interesting now?
Well, I'm reading a lot of interesting things. John Spike's Young Michelangelo just came out and is a wonderful book, as all his books are. I'm also reviewing Gary Trudeau's 40th anniversary volume of his Doonesbury series, a big, handsome book.
Mm-hmm.
And the amazing way he can keep up with timely events and treat them seriously and yet still be funny is something I can't fathom.
Well, Gary Wills, thank you very much for talking with us today.
It was a pleasure.
Gary Wills, whose memoir is called Outside Looking In, Adventures of an Observer.
The Israeli writer and peace activist David Grossman first achieved fame in the late 1980s for The Yellow Wind, a nonfiction book about the life of Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Since then, he's become internationally acclaimed for a series of novels, including Sea Under Love and The Book of Intimate Grammar. His latest novel, To the End of the Land, was written under the shadow of personal tragedy, and our critic at large, John Power, says it's a great novel about the invasion of private life by public history.
It's part of our national ethos that most Americans see themselves as free, self-defining individuals. In many other countries, that's impossible to do. You see, history is constantly rubbing up against you. Nowhere is that truer than in the Holy Land. I was reminded of this as I read To the End of the Land, the latest novel by David Grossman, the brilliant Israeli writer and activist who some call the conscience of his country. An honorific I sure don't envy him. I have enough trouble being the conscience of myself without having to do the job for millions of other people. That said, To the End of the Land is a novel that, among many other things, is about conscience. Its heroine is Ora, a gray-haired mother of two, recently separated from her husband. When her beloved son Ofer goes off on a military operation, Ora is terrified for his life. But rather than wait for the so-called notifiers to show up at her door with horrible news, she leaves Jerusalem. This is at once a form of magical thinking. If she's not there to get the bad news, then Ofer won't be hurt, and a way of refusing to be part of the war-making process. And so Ora hikes for days in the hills of Galilee along with her former lover Avram, from whom she's been estranged for decades. As the two climb between terebinth trees and placards devoted to those killed in Israel's wars, Ora tells her life story. We learn all about her and her husband Ilan, their two sons Ofer and Adam, and the family life they built. Along the way, we also learn what happened during the Yom Kippur War that turned Avram, once a sprightly source of exuberant artistry, into a quiet man who's retreated from the world. Grossman began working on this book when his son Yuri was in the army, and he hoped that writing it would somehow protect him. It didn't. Yuri and his tank mates were killed by a rocket in southern Lebanon. Naturally, this gives to The End of the Land a moving resonance. But Grossman would be the first to say that this doesn't guarantee its literary merit or give it any special moral authority on questions of war and peace. If the book was only about Ora fearing for her son, it would be just another boringly well-meaning anti-war novel. In fact, it's much, much more. For starters, Ora's story is about living in a country defined by what's known simply as the situation, the daily pressure of Middle Eastern history with its hatred and pettiness and killing. The book's original Hebrew title is A Woman Flees News, and the point is that Israelis can't really flee it and remain Israelis. And this exacts all sorts of costs on everyone, Jews and Arabs alike. Ora isn't simply worried that Ofer will be killed, but that in the ugly process of fighting the nation's battles, he will turn into someone she can't approve of, a hyper-masculine thug. She wants him and Israel to have a clear conscience. Then again, if To the End of the Land were only about the soul of Israel, it would feel abstract, unemotional. Instead, it's enormously powerful. Grossman has a feel for the fury and mire of domestic life, for the thrilling sound of the individual human voice. I've read few novels that capture so well the adventure of raising kids. Grossman has always been drawn to the magic of childhood, and to the way that men's bantering conversation can close out women, even a mother who loves them. At the center of all this stands the unforgettable figure of Ora, a woman at once nurturing and exhausting, sensual and deeply moral, boundlessly garrulous and not a little secretive, a life force and a real piece of work. As both a devoted mother of two sons and a loyal daughter of Israel, she yearns to be free of the moral and physical threats that are the very air she must breathe. But like Grossman, she knows there's no escape from history, let alone what lies beneath it, the terrible fragility of families and nations and all we hold dear.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. You can read an excerpt of David Grossman's new novel, To the End of the Land, on our website, freshair.npr.org.
Many of us might feel challenged to use the words hot, Amish, and romance in the same sentence, but Amish romances, bonnet rippers as they're sometimes called in the trade, have become a popular specialty in romance novels. The characters can be interesting, conflicted human beings who are abrim with passion, temptation, and faith. Shelley Shepherd Gray is the author of two series of Amish romance novels, Sisters of the Heart and The Seasons of Sugar Creek. She joins us from Cincinnati Public Radio in Cincinnati, Ohio. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
And we should explain you are not Amish, right?
No, I am not. I grew up in Houston, Texas, so I'm a city girl writing Amish novels.
And how did that happen?
It just so happens that I live here in southern Ohio, just an hour away from an Amish community. So I already loved visiting Adams County and the stores and the shops there, and so it just seemed a natural progression. I went ahead and gave it a try, and before I knew it, I had quite a few friends in the Amish community, and especially up in Sugar Creek, and I've just gone forward from there.
Mm. We should explain that the Amish romance is considered, and we're speaking in commercial terms now, a subgenre of Christian romance novels. Why do you think they've become so popular, and clearly not just with Amish readers?
You know, I've thought a lot about this, and I really firmly believe that a lot of people reach out to inspirational romances because they are looking for something positive and uplifting. for themselves. They don't want to be offended by too much language that's offensive, or, of course, there's no sex in these books, so they don't want anything like that. So I think that might be part of the interest. Also, I think there's a lot of very fine authors in the genre.
Mm. Do you have any reason to think that there are Amish readers of the books, too?
Oh, I know there's Amish readers. My friend Clara is an Old Order Amish up in Sugar Creek. And it turns out that we both shared a love of books. And when she gave me a tour of her home, she showed me one of her prized rooms, and it was a bookcase full of Christian romances, lots of them Amish romances. So every time I finish a manuscript or finish a book, my very first copy, I always send it out to Clara and then wait anxiously for her handwritten note to tell me what she thought.
Mm-hmm. No sex in the book, as you mentioned. But
no.
But a theme you return to seems to be the Amish person who has a flirtation and sometimes more with an Englisher.
Yes.
An outsider.
Mm-hmm. I've written that a couple of times. In Autumn's Promise, Lily is English. That's my heroine. And she does fall in love with an Amish man named Robert.
And when we say English, we don't mean like Tony Blair. We mean...
Oh, you're right. I'm sorry. Yeah, any person not Amish would be called an English or an Englisher by the Amish. And their story kind of falls over the whole seasons of Sugar Creek series.
Mm. So these are real human situations. This is not kind of an Amish Disneyland that you write about.
You know, I think so. I think everyone has crossroads in their lives. Things have happened to them that they don't plan on. The theme of my first book in the Seasons of Sugar Creek series is called Winter's Awakening. And really the theme of the whole novel is a lot of people are at a point in their lives where the things they had planned on, they're not so sure that that's exactly the direction they want to go. And I think all of us, especially, you know, when I was younger and just starting out, you kind of think, you know, gosh, is this really what I want to do? This is what I planned on. So hopefully readers can feel those same feelings.
Ms. Gray, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Shelley Shepherd Gray speaking with us from the studios of Cincinnati Public Radio. She's written two series of Amish romance novels. Her newest book, Autumn's Promise. Her forthcoming Christmas book is Grace, published by Avon and Spire, an imprint of HarperCollins. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you. I was delighted to be here with you.
Dino Mengistu's new novel opens with a sad scene. Mariam, young woman sitting in a car in Peoria, Illinois, preparing to go on a road trip to Nashville with her husband, Yosef, whom she's not really known for 3 years after he fled Ethiopia for America. Yosef has escaped some terrible things, and he takes them out, bruise by bruise, on Mariam. The novel is narrated a generation later by their son, Jonas Waldemariam, who will make his own journey to retrace their lives as his own marriage unravels in New York. How to Read the Air is Dino Mengistu's highly anticipated second novel, following The Beautiful Things That Heaven Bears. He joins us from our studios in New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Scott. It's a pleasure to be here.
And it's irresistible to note there are a lot of parallels between, well, a few certainly noticeable parallels between your life and the lives of some of your characters, because you were born in Ethiopia, came to the United States when you were two, and then during a time that was called the Red Terror. And I gather you grew up in Peoria for a while.
I did. It was the first landscape that I really have distinct memories of. And so when I began writing this novel, it seemed almost inevitable, if not natural, that I would want to return to that place and return to that time period.
So invites the question, are the similarities just superficial? You needed a background for a character, or there's something more at work here?
You know, there's a friend of mine who told me another writer had once told him that, you know, if you begin with certain facts from your own life, you're that much more freer in your own mental space to imagine the rest. And I think there's a real truth to that. For me, the particularities of growing up in Peoria were the things I kind of needed to actually ground and root the novel in my head. And once I had that setting and that place in my mind really fixed, then I was really able to create characters who are distinctly and dramatically different from my own personal experiences.
The novel has two parallel narratives, Yosef and Mariam. as we mentioned, and then a generation later, Jonas and his American wife, Angela. Real practical question first. How do you plot narratives that go in and out of each other like that? I mean, index cards, do they have computer software these days?
I wish they had computer software, because I'm sort of generally terrible about plotting out my work as I'm writing. You know, the novel really began with Yosef and Miriam and was very much an investigation of their marriage as it's being seen through their son a generation later. And it wasn't really until I understood their marriage and all the things that could possibly have gone wrong in their relationship that I was able to get a sense of the narrator's voice and understand who their son was. And then that's when I realized that there were actually two marriages happening at the same time, and then that sort of back-and-forth process.
Jonas goes to work for an agency that handles asylum cases in New York. And it's a very cynical business, the way you describe it. He makes things up.
The way we sort of have come to think of the idea of the immigrant narrative or the immigrant story, I think it's kind of hard not to be a little cynical about that. It's very easy to sort of consider it as one simple story that we've all heard and we've all grown very familiar to. And, you know, I can see that with my own work's reception sometimes, where people will say, it's an immigrant novel, it's an immigrant story. And oftentimes that can be enough to sum up the entire narrative in people's minds without knowing any of the details or facts, because all you need to know is that the person came from Africa or they came from X country that has X number of problems, and therefore to actually understand the particulars of those stories seems like a burden sometimes, and so people would rather have a kind of general flat story that they're already familiar with. And the narrative,
the flat story being they've seen terrible things, they're here to change their lives.
Exactly, and isn't it also awful over there, and now that they're here, let's make, you know, their lives will be better. And Jonas is very aware of that.
I mean, let's explain how it goes practically. People will come to him and they'll have a story about why they fled their country, but he feels he's got to embroider it to have a chance of making an impression. So it's, you've got two kids, let's make that six, sort of thing.
Part of what Jonas, I think, is doing in those situations is he's aware of the fact that for most people, the worse the narrative is, the more acceptable and the more manageable it is for people to understand and sympathize with.
I want to get to the life that Jonas's mother, Mariam, has. There are many sections that recount the bruises and worse that she is dealt by her husband, Yosef. And I think most readers will read those sections and scream out, "Leave him." I wonder if you can read a section from this book in which, maybe you can set it up for us. Jonas is the narrative voice.
So this is Jonas. He's been retracing his parents' road trip through the Midwest, and he stops at a landmark that his parents had stopped off in outside of Peoria, Illinois. And he's imagining his mother as she was when she was at this place with his father, and he's trying to imagine what would have happened if she had been able to leave his father at that moment. As she runs, she grows more confident in her footing. She stumbles less and quickly learns to spot the clearings ahead. Leaves rush by, and as she runs, she can't help thinking to herself there's no stopping her now. She's an athlete, a long-distance, gold-medal-winning Ethiopian runner, capable of heroic feats of endurance and strength, and soon the world will know her name. If there are barriers before her, she would hurl them in one long, clean stride, a gazelle in disguise. An army of men couldn't catch her. Their bullets, arrows, and rocks, along with their violent, angry words, all would tear harmlessly by or fall uselessly to the ground in her dust. And how long could she keep this up? Not long at all. 5, or let me be generous because this is my mother and it's hard not to be, and say 10 minutes at most. And then what? There's nowhere to go then but back, which is precisely where she and I are headed now. But God, what a beautiful run we might have had.
That's heart-piercing. Jonas, in the course of the narrative, becomes a school teacher, and he has his students are interested in his background, and he applies his storytelling talents to that too. And when he makes up stories for his students about his father, that's the father he wished he'd had?
It's both. It's the father he wishes he had and the father he had, and if anything, the two need to be sort of reconciled. You know, he needs to understand exactly how his father became this angry, violent man, and by the end of his life, this sort of angry, violent, frightened, and shriveled man. And he has, for the most of his life, avoided trying to understand what made him into that person. And once he begins imagining this story, he is actually concerned enough with his father's life to actually figure out, well, how did this man become who he was, and how could he have actually been possibly a better person if this had not happened to him? So it's very much, I think, a melding of fact and fiction and hope at the same time.
I made a note of a line that really got to me, uttered by one of your characters towards the end, Angela, who, of course, is married and then gets a divorce from Jonas. But she says, well, doesn't seem to be afraid of death or suffering so much as she says she's afraid of disappearing.
Hmm.
She says, I'm afraid to find someday there's no one who knows me anymore. I could disappear and who would care? Is that one of the driving forces of our lives?
I think it is. I think the compulsion to find close attachments is sort of enormously and profoundly rooted in the fact that it's so easy to find yourself feeling weightless in the world and to find yourself sort of almost dispensable. I think, you know, it's very easy to feel like you're being whittled away bit by bit in the world, and that what pieces of you are left could easily be scattered if there's nothing to hold on to or no one to hold on to you.
Dino Mengistu, his new novel, How to Read the Air. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.